Hi, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. When someone writes a book about this nation's principal federal law enforcement agency titled Your FBI, How the FBI Suppresses Whistleblowers to Hide FBI Scandals and Crimes, and when that someone is a former supervisory special agent of the FBI, there is cause, I think you'll agree, for alarm. Rosemary Dew is an FBI whistleblower, and her book is an anthology of stories, including hers, about the shocking fates of agents who stepped up to point out wrongdoing. Former agent Dr. Tyrone Powers, whose story is also in this book, eloquently explains the FBI's institutional response to whistleblowers. When a whistleblower has conscience and courage, writes Dr. Powers, the FBI reacts like an immune system that has to fight them off because conscience and courage might be contagious. They fight them with every white blood cell they have. Even if the whistleblower's right, the FBI considers them an infection rather than something that might help the agency to grow. But the FBI does not grow. They swell with the infection of wrongdoing. Today, Rosemary Dew and I are going to talk about this infection. We're going to talk about the FBI's retaliation playbook, its victims, and the implication of all these for the United States. Welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you very much.
So let's just start this off with your story. I mean, I'm sure that's what inspired you to put this book together. So
it was one of the things. I know a lot of the whistleblowers, and we began to realize that, you know, every once in a while you get a news story about an FBI whistleblower. Colleen Raleigh, for example, Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, Jane Turner, who reported on the theft from 9/11. So these stories hit the news and then they just fade away, and all people think of is television FBI. They don't really realize how much this affects their civil rights, and it does profoundly.
Well, I'll tell you, these stories were so shocking to me. You talk about Jane Turner. I mean, everybody heard knows about Fred. I mean, the details of his story, we'll do a few details from several stories. I actually want to do a series on this show of interviews with everybody, because each story is its own fresh piece of hell with different aspects of malfeasance, institutional malfeasance being visited in the area which that person where that person was working, and the circumstances, I mean, which is why, you know, I really want you to talk about your own personal story first, because I want people to get a firsthand, a firsthand look at how it works.
Okay. Well, I became an agent in 1977. I was the 96th woman. I encountered sexual harassment and sexual discrimination right off the bat, you know. Started in the academy, but for example, in my first office, my welcome visit to my new supervisor consisted of him telling me they had one like me before. And I assumed that was a single parent. I was the third woman agent in San Francisco division. So there had not been many women before me. But his idea was that I would ask for special privileges and I wouldn't pull my weight. That was his assumption right off the bat. So it was a difficult welcome. The sexual harassment started right away. For example, I'd been there about 4 months. I was 27, which at the age of 70, which I am now, I see it's still a child. But I had such high hopes and I was so naive. A supervisor called me. I was in the Berkeley resident agency, which is a small office. He was in the Oakland resident agency. I was already getting a lot of calls for undercover work because there were so few women. He told me that he needed to talk to me about an undercover and lived not too far from me, so he would just drop by my house after work.
Oh.
Well, I really didn't
get
at that point what a problem that might be. We didn't have good secure communications, for example. It made sense to me that he couldn't describe it over the phone, and I didn't want to drive to Oakland. And besides, he said he was busy. So anyway, he called me a few times during the evening saying he was going to be later, and each time he seemed increasingly more drunk. I could tell he was in a restaurant or a bar. He came into my house where I had two small children who, praise the Lord, were asleep. He shoved a bottle of wine in my hands, asked me to go get glasses. I had to wash a couple of glasses, so it took me a while. When I came back, he was naked.
Oh!
And he kind of chased me around, telling me he knew from the moment he saw me that there was chemistry between us, and he's trying to kiss me, and I'm trying to shove his clothes back at him. It was just awful. I did what many women do when they're assaulted. I somewhat froze. All I could do was talk. I tried to kid him out of it. I just tried to push him away. Eventually, he was so drunk, it was obvious he couldn't perform, so he left. I went back in the office. I talked to one of the senior agents about what had happened, and I said, you know, how can I report this? And he said, oh, you don't want to do that. Don't call attention to yourself. I trusted him. And as it turns out, over the years, I learned that was good advice because nothing was going to happen to the man who tried to attack me. He became an assistant director. I'm sure I was not his only victim. In fact, I know when he left the office, they wrapped up a dead rat and gave it to him for going away present. Nonetheless,
yeah,
law enforcement humor. So then I went on to the Washington field office, and I was working on a counterintelligence squad. My greeting was one of the guys saying he kept the flow chart for the women in the office, and so I should just tell him when my period is.
God.
There was, they were putting up little cartoons. One was a cartoon of a woman who was bent over with her head stuck up her rear, and they put a caption on it, a typical CI2 female agent. That was my squad number. It was right where I had to sign in. I kept taking it down. They kept putting it up. I finally went into my supervisor and said, you know, we have to stop this. And he said, oh, you got to have thick skin. I'm Greek. People kid me about being Greek. He said, if you try to take this further, it's only going to get worse. Again, this guy I actually trusted, and I knew he was right. I was too junior to have the confidence to do any more. And then one day I was sitting at my desk and some of the surveillance personnel came in and said that one of my colleagues had stolen a car from out in front of the Soviet embassy and had just driven off with it, parked, and walked away. Well, he had told me before he thought that it would be really a good idea because then the person who owned the car would think they were crazy because they would not find their car in the same place. Not really sure where he was going with that. Didn't make sense to me. Didn't have a warrant, by the way. But the surveillance personnel were afraid to report it themselves. They weren't agents, and they thought I would survive the experience better. I took up their cause. I went to my supervisor. I think the embassy called and complained, and I think that's what finally pushed him to action. However, I don't actually know if he was punished or not, the guy who did that. His nickname was Grand Theft Auto.
Oh.
That's what he was known to people for. This man followed me throughout my career. When I went to headquarters, not like stalking, but we just ended up thrown together.
Same places, being transferred to the same places at the same time.
Yeah. So I went to headquarters. I was a supervisor in counterintelligence and counterterrorism, two separate assignments. But while I was in counterintelligence, I got a call, and someone was saying that this man had inappropriate contacts with a defector. So he was still on the squad, the same supervisor I'd been talking about all along. I call the supervisor and I say, you know, this, you got to stop it. You know, first of all, there should have been an investigation. He should not have been doing what he was doing. And I'm sorry, but most of my story is still classified, so I can't give you the details on what he was doing. At the end of that conversation, my supervisor said, you know, I said, he's just not a stable guy. And the supervisor responded, you're not stable either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I wasn't at the field office again. I don't know what happened with this guy. He had access to some very highly classified cases that went awry and resulted in some deaths. He was one of the few people in the office, but for some reason, there's no alarm bells going off. So then I get transferred to Denver, where a number of things happened. I was the first woman to be a supervisor there. The special agent in charge had wanted a man with lesser qualifications, quite frankly. It was a counterintelligence and counterterrorism squad. I had been a supervisor in both at headquarters, worked internationally, handled thousands of FBI cases from that desk. Apparently, before I got there, he went to everyone that I would supervise and the outside agencies I would have liaison with and told them I wasn't qualified for the job and that it was being forced on him. Fortunately, I had just super people on the squad that I supervised, as well as the liaison contacts, and very quickly they realized, you know, who wasn't qualified for the job.
Right, right.
So eventually there was a very powerful man in the office who lost some classified and lied about it. Because I was the counterintelligence supervisor, I had to investigate him. He lied under oath. He did have power over me, so I should not have been involved in that investigation at all, but that's the way the special charge wanted it.
Okay.
The classified information that he lost was returned to us through a biker gang.
Oh, God.
Yeah. They're being investigated for drugs, and some of them, I guess, had been working in the office, and because even though I asked over and over again, we didn't have safes for all the classified information. His classified was left out and they stole it.
Unbelievable. Anyway,
yeah, he became an assistant director.
So people fail up in the FBI, it seems.
If it comes to a whistleblower case, yes, that's absolutely true.
Unbelievable.
And my theory is that everybody knows what's going on, and therefore everyone's given a tacit, consent to this. So if it's revealed, then everybody's in trouble.
Exactly.
So, you know, they're going to line up behind the abuser. So then Grand Theft Auto's back. This time, I got a call from Washington Field, and they said, did you tell this man you would give him access to our classified computing system? I said, no, I did not. And they said, don't worry, you're not the first one. So here he is attempting to commit espionage, basically. And no one has confronted him about it. You know, I called headquarters again and told them what had happened. I don't know what the follow-up was, except that I know they sent the same supervisor out to talk to him so he wouldn't do it again. Then he got picked up by the Denver police for exposing himself and leaving his FBI business card.
Oh my God.
he actually was not in the bureau at that point. And what happened was while he was still on duty in Washington Field, there was a secretary who was actually a minor. She was just out of high school, and he trapped her in a stairwell and tried to shove her hands down his pants. And I think that was actually his demise. But
finally.
Yeah.
God. God.
Anyway, these were very serious national security concerns. And, you know, it was just blown off. I eventually left. I left after 13 years. Denver was my last office.
The
FBI was not what I thought it was going to be, and fidelity, bravery, and integrity is not what the FBI stands for.
There are a couple of other women who are in this book, and one of them I hope she will allow me to talk to her, but her situation is so inhuman, really. Could you talk about her?
Yes. She was attacked by a very powerful man.
Her name is Teresa Foley.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I thought you were talking about
Jane. Who?
Suzanne Doucette.
Oh, we'll talk about Suzanne. Talk about Susan.
She was attacked by a special agent in charge in an elevator, put his hands all over her, told her she was married. Her husband was still in New York, but he was under transfer to, if I remember correctly, this was Phoenix. And told her if she didn't sleep with him, he would kill the transfer. Now, this man had gotten away with something really big when he was in the Midwest, and that was harassment of a man named Donald Roshan. Roshan was an African-American. What they did to him was horrible. They took out life insurance policies in his name and sent them to the house as basically a threat. They put gorilla pictures over his child's face, the picture he had on his desk. They harassed his wife. It just went on and on and on. And when there was an investigation of this, everyone said, well, we were just kidding. And that was accepted. So if he presided over that, and there was a big lawsuit over
that.
He got away with it. Mm-hmm. And the best that ever happens to any of these people is they're transferred and allowed to retire with full benefits.
Well, that's some of them get promoted, from what I read. Many of them get promoted. So what happened with Suzanne?
Almost all.
Yeah. What happened with Suzanne? Did she reported this? And
She reported it. She actually filed a lawsuit. And in her case, she tried to resign and the Bureau wouldn't let her. And this is kind of an interesting thing, because if you are an FBI agent, you can't have another job. So their purpose was to keep her from working while this lawsuit was going on. She wasn't in the office. She was on leave without pay. So she had no income. And so they wouldn't take her badge back. So she finally testified before Congress, and then they said, okay, you can go.
Okay, I want to talk about Jane Turner's case. We'll talk about Teresa in a second, because Jane Turner's case was really, besides the fact, I mean, to me, she was labeled a troublemaker when she blew the whistle on some agents stealing 9/11 artifacts that belong to the victims' families of 9/11. Okay, so all of a sudden she's flagged. Then she gets transferred to what was the name? Fort Berthold. It's an Indian reservation.
Where she actually started out at the Indian reservations, and that's where she did her first whistleblowing.
So I have the time.
It's just, yeah. She worked, there's some strange laws having to do with law enforcement on Indian reservations, and the FBI has primary jurisdiction in a serious felony. I've been told it's because the Bureau of Indian Affairs on the reservations, they have jails. And they can hold someone for a year. So if anything's more serious than that, a murder, a rape, a felony child abuse, then it has to be FBI jurisdiction. But it is a very low priority for the FBI. And Jane was one of the few people who worked these cases diligently.
You have to explain that on these reservations, the abuse of women and children is off the chain. It's incredibly prolific. Mm-hmm. And there are certain customs. In her case, she ran into trouble when a case that another agent had closed, right? Which was the case of a young child, 3 years old, who had been sodomized by his father. Mm-hmm. And the tribal police couldn't do anything about it because you're not supposed to report those kinds of crimes, family, crimes that a family commits, because he was the cousin of this father, apparently. Mm-hmm. So you take it from there, what happened to Jane. I couldn't believe this.
Well, Jane walked into a hospital on another case, and in the course of that investigation, a doctor said, hey, whatever happened with this three-year-old? She said, it was so bad that my staff had to go through psychological counseling after dealing with the case. That's how injured this child was. The agent came in, a man, he didn't want to work the case. So he went to the United States Attorney's Office and said, I don't think we need to prosecute this because it was just a vehicular accident. Okay, so how a vehicular accident could cause tears in that child's rectum so badly that there had to be a surgical repair, and that a medical staff that is used to seeing child abuse cases has to go through psychological.
He knew he was lying.
He was lying. And the doctor wrote a letter that says, and it's in the book, but she says, sometimes there are gray areas. There were no gray areas on this. There were no bruises, as if a car ran over him. She said there was dirt on the child's belly. Most likely he was bent over a car or a tire and it deposited the dirt, but there were no marks.
Well, I mean, the father in the end admitted to doing it. Mm-hmm. And Meanwhile, Jane gets into trouble for pursuing that case.
Yes. And they actually transferred her to Minneapolis. It was like the weekend after she closed on a house in Minot, which is where she was. They told her she was going to handle the overall program, Crimes Against Children, for the division. But when she got there, she had a chair, but no desk. She was seated separately from the squad, and she had no cases. So this is a pretty typical path that the FBI takes for whistleblowers. First, they isolate them. Jane's not the only one. Robert Kobus spent 2 years on the 25th floor of the
24th floor,
in New York. No empty. Responsibilities. It's completely empty.
Oh, just like 130 guests, not one other soul, no phone, no nothing.
Mm-mm. No. So he was a senior GS-13. So he's being paid like, you know, $120,000 a year to do nothing, and was not allowed to do anything. He wanted to work, but okay. So I'm going far afield on this, but so that's what they did to Jane. First, they isolated her. Then,
and let's be clear, before Jane came, there were no prosecutions of these crimes. Mm-hmm. She investigated and got a bunch of them prosecuted. Mm-hmm. And then when she left, again, back to zero. And in the case of this raped child, the guy who stopped her from doing it, in the end gets credit.
Yes.
For getting this case solved.
Yes. And, you know, when they took her off that case, they returned that child to the father. Oh. So, I mean, it's just unconscionable. But anyway, yes, they gave that man credit. He became an assistant special agent in charge. On and on and on. Everyone who persecuted her, and believe me, she was persecuted, was promoted. It was completely covered up. They reduced her in rank. But what they did was they wouldn't give her any cases, because if she did well on a case, then they'd have to rate her down. They didn't want to do that anymore. She had always had excellent performance appraisals, and they wanted to get rid of her. Once they isolated her, and there's a nickname for this in the FBI, it's called being radioactive. And if you're radioactive, nobody wants to get near you. Everybody knows if they associate with you, they're going to have the same kind of harassment that you do. I mean, they put up her picture at the Christmas party and made cracks about her looks. No one would work with her. She is very creative. So she started working with other agencies to get cases done. So they sent her for a psychological fitness for duty. And they did this to Fred Whitehurst too. Yep. This is illegal for anyone other than federal employees who have clearances. So the FBI keeps a group of psychologists and psychiatrists on retainer. They send the person to them who's going to be evaluated. The only information that the psychologists and psychiatrists have comes from the FBI and is written up by exactly the people who are abusing them. And for example, in Jane's case, they said she was delusional. And they said that because she worked on a case, and it was a pretty famous case, an espionage case. It was called The Falcon and the Snowman. There was a movie about it. So it's an old espionage case. One of them, Christopher Boyce, escaped from prison. So what she worked on was recapturing Christopher Boyce. She is written up in a book called Flight of the Falcon. She has a letter of commendation from the Attorney General concerning this case. And Minneapolis told these psychiatrists that she made this up.
Oh.
And whenever she would try to defend herself, they would say, why would the FBI lie? And that Fred has told me the same thing. Anytime he would say, you know, try to contradict the paper that the FBI had sent, they would say, why would the FBI lie? So in the end, they diagnosed Jane. I don't remember the exact diagnosis, but it was, you know, delusional and this and that, but in remission.
Now, in remission?
In remission. I'm a nurse. You can't diagnose something you didn't see. So they never saw during the interview, they could not find any pathology. So they just said it was there, but it was in remission.
So I went through that book.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wanted, you know, I like things. I like to document things. And I said, I want to document this retaliation playbook. So I found 22 things that are part of the playbook.
Mm-hmm.
So order psychiatric evaluations, make you look morally corrupt, take your gun under the guise that to humiliate you and prevent you from working, mm-hmm. remove you from your assigned duties, deny you equipment you need to do your work, reduce your staff or take it away entirely, deny access to systems you need for your work, isolated from your co-workers, given a chair but no desk, prohibit co-workers from talking to you because that would be guilt by association,
mm-hmm.
put you in working conditions that endanger your health, that we'll get to Teresa Foley in a minute, surveil you, investigate you, troll for information to discredit you, including questioning co-workers, outside professional contacts, friends, family, about your spending habits, sexual habits, and medical history. Transfer you repeatedly to drive you to resign. If you're undercover, make your name public. Transfer you out of your job a million times. Deny you authorization for new training. Block you from doing your job and then change your performance ratings from excellent to subpar. Disappear documents you sent to investigative files so management can accuse you of not doing your job. Accuse you of crimes that can be easily disproven, but force you to go on endure a criminal investigation. Cover up the malfeasance you blew the whistle on by promoting or giving an award to the person involved in the malfeasance. Highlight examples of your attacks on whistleblowers, the FBI's attacks on whistleblowers, to create an atmosphere of fear to deter others. Those were the things I found. Do you have anything to add to this?
No, I think you got it. But the point is, it's a pattern. It's not something that happened to one person. It is what will happen to you if you speak out.
Yes. And the other thing is, we should get to this. Let's talk about Teresa. But after that, what I want to talk about is, you know, you have all these offices you can go to. You have the Whistleblower Protection Act, and yet you've got this CAFES nightmare for whistleblowers. So I want to talk about that. But first, let's talk about Teresa Foley, because her story is a nightmare. Go ahead.
Teresa was assigned to Guantanamo Bay interrogating prisoners. The office was very harassing. She encountered that right away. She did not want to go drink with the guys. Her supervisor actually called her in and said, you know, you have to go to these parties, you know, you have to go drink with them. Otherwise, you're not part of the family. She started reporting things, time card frauds, making a bigger issue of the sexual harassment. and bad things started happening to her. First of all, when she arrived, she was put in rat-infested housing. It had been abandoned for a while, or not occupied, I should say, for a while. The last occupants had left food all over the place. The place was just...
Oh, in the tropics, that means rats.
Yeah. Cuba, yeah. The place was filthy. There was rotting food. The furniture was stained. Some people, she wasn't the only one who had the filthy furniture, because some people had to throw theirs out because it began to itch once they sat down in it.
Fleas or something? Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. What? So,
but Teresa's was a very notorious, was very notorious housing. She was in that by herself. She had a roommate temporarily, but
yeah, Teresa, she was there for a year, right? She was assigned for a year.
And they wouldn't move her. Within the first 2 weeks, I believe, first 10 days, started coming into the office with bites, with swelling. People were commenting on it. She kept going to the base hospital, but they didn't know what it was. She became sicker and sicker. She finally flew to Florida to Cleveland Clinics, and they were unable to diagnose her. She continued to be sick.
This was a woman who was like a marathon runner or something. I mean, she was in tip-top shape.
She had running trophies.
A real athlete.
By the time she left there, she couldn't walk. Since then, she's had spinal fusions. What happened was she developed a disease called leptospirosis. If you look that one up on the internet, you'll find, flu-like symptoms, but some people die. And you won't get any more information than that. But if you look in medical literature, you'll see that she has if you get the heavy case, she has the classic symptoms. The worst, well, it's hard to say which is the worst, because it affects, you can have hemorrhaging into your lungs. Of course, she had many respiratory emergencies that landed her in the hospital. One of the things that can cause is rhabdomyolysis. What that is, it means melting muscles, basically. And it attacks the muscles that hold up your spine. So that's the reason that she's had the spine.
And you get it from rat urine, don't you?
Yeah. Rodents, other things can carry it, but rodents are the classic. So the Bureau decided that that's not what she had. She was eventually sent back to Boston because she was so sick. She saw a Harvard doctor. He did lab tests and diagnosed her through the lab tests and his personal observation with this disease. The Bureau said, absolutely, no, that's not what she's got. They don't examine her.
No FBI doctors examined her, and one FBI doctor testified that, she left Gitmo with a sinus infection or something.
And never returned to duty.
Right.
That is what they said in court. The judge accepted that, gave what's called summary judgment, which meant that her attorney couldn't even argue the case. At that point, years had passed, but the one important detail that I've left out here is they wouldn't give her workers' compensation. She ran out of all her leave. Her medical bills were mounting up. Finally, Senator Kennedy got involved. All of a sudden, she gets workers' compensation. So I have to ask, when were they lying?
Exactly.
They said she didn't deserve it and didn't have leptospirosis. Or when they said she did, because the political pressure. She continues to struggle to this day. She will never walk again without a cane.
And how old is she?
She might be 50 by now. This has gone on for more than a decade. Getting compensation and her medical taken care of, still the Bureau still has influence on that, and everything she has to fight for And in her case, she's had this infection for so long that it has pretty much killed her immune system. So if she has to go to the emergency room, she picks up a disease. And when she picks up a disease, it's really much more rampant than what you or I would get from that. So it puts her in the hospital a lot.
So let's talk about this system that, you know, that FBI whistleblowers have to subject themselves to. First of all, the FBI is governed by whistleblower laws that are separate from any other agencies, including the Department of Justice, under which they sit. So just talk about that and how some of these offices, and I point out specifically the Office of Professional Responsibility, are sometimes complicit in persecuting whistleblowers. But just talk about this whole Kafkaesque, you know, network of agencies and laws and, the Whistleblower Protection Act of 2016 with its loophole.
Yes, the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2016. What that did was effectively stop any employee who is a whistleblower from being able to go to court. It keeps the investigations within the FBI and the Department of Justice, which both of which have been proven over and over again to protect the FBI and not take care of a whistleblower. One of the things that the Office of Professional Responsibility quite frequently does is when somebody blows the whistle, they open an investigation on the whistleblower. And that's the beginning. They try to discredit you, as you were explaining earlier, with criminal acts or, immoral behavior, all kinds of stuff. So now there's no recourse outside of the FBI and the Department of Justice.
And that makes no sense because it's a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. If it's this agency and the agency that's over that agency are the ones to look into the crimes and malfeasance of that age, it's a complete conflict of interest. And it's borne out by what happens.
Mm-hmm. And what Mike German documented, he's an attorney, was that the Inspector General, the FBI Office of Professional Responsibility, the FBI inspection staff, everyone who is involved along the way in investigating these cases were coordinating. In the case of EEO cases, they were coordinating as well with the Department of Justice in favor of the FBI. There's no independent review. They claim there is an administrative judge situation within the Department of Justice, and therefore you have a hearing before a judge, but it's really not true. If you file to have that review, the investigation is what they attorneys call de novo, meaning that has to start all over. The whistleblower has to get an attorney, basically file for discovery, completely reconstruct the investigation. Can't use past investigations. They have to start all over again. They drive the whistleblower into bankruptcy. They string this out for several have been strung out over a decade. The resolution is, for those who have not been able to go to court, the resolution is always negative, with the exception of one person, Robert Kobus. They did see that keeping him unoccupied for 2 years was a waste of taxpayer dollars. However, everyone involved was promoted, except Robert. The only way an FBI employee can go to court for a whistleblower claim is if they are a certain class of military veteran. Not all military veterans they're called preference eligible, and they have to have certain campaign ribbons to be able to go before the Merit Systems Board,
right?
Performance Board, I think it is. Anyway, their purpose is to protect veterans who are being wrongfully fired. So they get a separate hearing there. And the other way they can go to court is by filing an EEO. But you have to be able to prove that there was some EEO aspect to the retaliation that you are, you know, having. And not every whistleblower can do that. I think most women can, but
most women can. Black folks can, Hispanics can, because there's across the board, the racism and sexism in the FBI is just, it's crazy.
And I would like to point out that as we speak, 17 women are suing the FBI. There's a class action suit for the sexual harassment and discrimination in the FBI Academy. That's where it starts.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Tyrone Powers was talking about how when he went to the Academy, he was in bed in his dorm room. He and his roommate were sleeping, and these guys dressed up as in sheets as KKK, you know, barged into the room to, you know, that was how it started with him at the FBI Academy.
Those were on-duty agents who did that, you know, noting that Dr. Powers is African-American.
Yes.
And they scared him to death.
Yes.
He didn't know what to do, but nothing happened to those people, I assure you. And the EEO process in the FBI, everybody I talked to who filed, their cases got lost. Teresa's was lost for at least a year. She kept pushing the EEO office and they found it. And then it went away for another year. I mean, it's
useless. This lost documentation is a running theme in these cases. Is Mike German, was he the one in the Tampa office? Mm-hmm. He's an undercover expert, and he was blowing the whistle on some illegal recording of a meeting between two terrorist groups, Muslim and white supremacists, right?
And his is such a good example of something that could have been healed.
Yeah, simple.
Easily. What happened was there was an illegal monitoring. It was an accident. They were trying to do a consensual monitoring. So they had an informant who went into a meeting. It's only consensual as long as the informant's in the room. But what he did was he left the recorder in a couch or a chair or something, and he went out to the bathroom. Immediately, that is an illegal monitoring. So it's obvious that the Bureau didn't contrive this situation. So what they would have to do is go through an administrative process to explain what happened, and, you know, perhaps go before a judge to explain what happened to be able to use the information. The information, which is in congressional. Record now, thanks to Senator Grassley plotting with the international.
Also like to attack Jews in this country and to, yeah, it was a horrible group. Two horrible groups of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is post 9/11.
It's an important recording.
Mm-hmm. And this is post 9/11.
Right. Right.
So it was the number one priority of the Bureau, but what the Bureau did was try to cover up the fact that the illegal monitoring took place.
Oh, yeah. His boss said, just pretend it didn't happen when Mike, and thus began his fresh hell.
Yeah.
You know, because he wasn't going to do that.
They put him under investigation. They said there was a $50 voucher fraud of some sort, which, of course, was not true. He had receipts for everything. But it's not like you hand them a receipt and they say, oops, that's not it. They keep investigating you and investigating you and investigating you. And they didn't even tell him. And he found out when someone, I think from inspection staff, told him, well, at least we found you didn't commit that fraud. He's like, what?
Right. Right. Well, let's be clear. What happened too was when he talked about this, he had a transcript of the recording. The Tampa office was saying, oh, there never was a recording. So he produces a transcript, and then all of a sudden the Tampa office finds the recording. So they were playing all kinds of games.
They asked him to turn over the transcript. He knew perfectly well that would make it go away for sure. He maintained a copy and stood his ground, and that's when Tampa found the tape, which was in the supervisor's desk drawer.
Right.
Yeah.
But Mike had to go all, and this is what happens to some of these people after years and years and years of fighting the bureaucracy. And by the way, we have to include, there's an office of the, you're supposed to go, you know, then they have to go to Congress and senators, and then the whole thing really blows up. Because what happened with Mike too is, after he went to Grassley, the FBI put out a press release, you know, impugning his integrity and all that. But there's this Office of Attorney Recruitment and Management. They're the ones that you're supposed to go to as, I don't know, are they supposed to represent you as attorneys in this whistleblower?
That is what they are calling an administrative judge. So they answer to the Attorney General, and they read all the paper. And again, this is the investigation that has to be de novo.
They don't have to give you, they don't have to tell you if they have come up with a decision, how, they don't have to divulge anything about how they came up with the decision to say, you're wrong or whatever. I mean, there's a lot, it's so rigged.
That, you know, that is correct. They will not give a whistleblower's attorney access to any precedent cases, which is very important in arguing a case. The government has access to all of them, but the whistleblower's attorneys do not. So they, it's very hard to make a case since our legal system is based upon precedent cases. The rulings are, it's hard to make a case when you don't know what the precedents are.
I mean, it's so interesting to me how each office has a critical piece of rigory going on. Okay, like, okay, you don't have your, you and your lawyer do not have access to the precedent cases. You know, and, you know, you've got these other offices that are coordinating with each other, mm-hmm. you know, the OPR in particular. I mean, so whenever they send you to any of these offices, they're really sending you into the buzzsaw.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, take the case of Jane Turner. When she reported that little boy, the OPR said, you know, there's no case here, Jane, as far as, you know, misconduct in the FBI. The head of that office retired a couple of years later and actually ended up being prosecuted for raping his six-year-old daughter. Of course he didn't think there was a problem.
I mean, so Rosemary, what's to be done?
Well, first of all, FBI whistleblowers should have the same protections that civil service whistleblowers do. The FBI will claim that it can't because of national security. That is completely false. All of these whistleblowers reported waste, fraud, and abuse. I've been able to tell you the story of abuse of classified information without giving you the details. These cases can be prosecuted in court and were up until the Enhancement Act. So
who was behind that Enhancement Act? I mean, it's almost Orwellian to call it an Enhancement Act, by the way, but
just what that act did that enhanced it. Before that act, there were only 9 offices that an FBI employee could report malfeasance to, and it did not include your chain of command.
It's crazy, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was the director of the FBI, the attorney general, the head of your office, but it is a chain of command structure, and just try jumping over your supervisor's head and see what happens to you. I mean, it's set up to be adversarial from the get-go. And most of the people before, well, all of the people, I should say, before the Enhancement Act were caught in not having protections, at least for a certain period of time, because they reported through their chain of command.
Well, what's interesting, though, about this Enhancement Act is that it puts the director, it implicates the director in covering up this malfeasance too, the FBI director. I mean, Mueller was directly implicated. I believe it was in Mike German's case, directly implicated, right?
Oh, quite a few of them. I know Robert Kobus contacted him. I'm pretty sure Darren Jones, who was reporting on contract frauds, contacted him. But the director signs off on all firings. The problem is the directors don't review these cases themselves. They're brought to them by legal counsel, and they pretty much get a briefing and give a signature.
Well, too bad. I mean, if the Whistleblower Enhancement Act gives you this kind of discretion, then you're responsible, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, somebody has to be held responsible. And I just think that, all right. So you think the Whistleblower Enhancement Act needs to be amended, right?
Yes, it does. And I think they just need to be rolled in with the civil service protections.
And who could do that? Who could do that?
Congress. Congress. Has to be legislation. Has to be legislation because it's law.
Your book should be sent to Senator Grassley, since he's helped a lot of these people with that recommendation. I'm going to leave it there because our time is up, Rosemary. Oh. But you have done a very valuable public service in exposing this, because you really expose it in all its disgusting, terribleness. I mean, it's almost so unspeakable, some of the stuff that I read in there in your book, and it really needs to be addressed, and you have made the case for that. So
thank you.
Thanks for coming on, and I hope to bring on every last one of your colleagues on this show.
I hope you do.
So my audience can really get a full picture, and maybe somebody will make a few of them will make a few calls. So thanks a lot, Rosemary.
Yeah, well, if they would do this to their employees, just imagine what they'll do to the public.
Exactly. Well, yeah, we didn't talk about that, how the U.S. pays for all this. But anyway, we'll do that. We'll do that in the subsequent interviews. Thank you.
Thank you so much.